All right, welcome in everyone to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going to be looking at a fascinating case. It's Commonwealth v. Clerk of the Boston Juvenile Court.
Oh, yeah, real classic.
Yeah. This is a Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court case, and it really gets at some of the fundamental ideas about how the legal system operates, the roles of the different actors, and especially for you all, future legal eagles, you're going to be dealing with these concepts day in and day out. So I thought this would be a great one to take a look at.
I think that's a great choice. It's one of those cases where on the surface, the situation seems kind of I don't know, almost a little mundane. But when you dig into it really reveals a lot about the complexities of our legal system.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking about a clerk magistrate, and the question at the heart of it is, what happens when they don't do what we'd normally expect? They don't outright approve or deny a criminal complaint. Instead, they just kind of put it on hold. It's like this legal limbo. And the case really clarifies that that kind of limbo doesn't really have a place within the structure that we have.
Yeah, it throws a real wrench in the gears, doesn't it?
So let's set the stage. We're in Brighton, Massachusetts, April 17th, 1998, and we have Greg Margolin and three other individuals, and they're all wearing yarmulkes. And unfortunately, they were subjected to some really awful verbal harassment. And it didn't stop there. It escalated to the point where somebody in a passing car actually threw a lit cigarette at them. Really disturbing incident.
Yeah, awful. And of course, the police got involved, they investigated, and their investigation pointed them to a juvenile who was driving the car. And this juvenile admitted to being involved. So, based on all that, a detective decided to seat a criminal complaint against the juvenile, specifically for a violation of civil rights. You'd think at that point the process is pretty straightforward. You apply for the complaint, it gets reviewed.
Right.
Seems logical, yeah. But this is where things take a turn that ultimately led to this case landing before the highest court in Massachusetts. So the clerk magistrate, instead of just going ahead and either granting or denying that application for the complaint, they chose a different path. They decided to hold it, quote unquote, open, and not just for a short period either. They set a date, December 31st, 1999. So we're talking about a delay of well over a year and a half.
Wow. Yeah, that's a significant amount of time.
Oh, absolutely. And on top of that, they even went ahead and imposed certain conditions on the juvenile during this whole open period, basically saying, no more incidents.
So it wasn't like everything was just frozen in time, just waiting. There were actual consequences, or at least potential consequences, in play.
Right. And that's what makes this whole situation so interesting, legally speaking. You see, the clerk magistrate, by doing this, essentially tried to create a third option, right? One that wasn't acknowledged in the existing legal structure. It wasn't a case actively moving forward, heading towards prosecution, but it wasn't dismissed either. It was in this strange in-between state. And as you can imagine, the Commonwealth, meaning the prosecution, they weren't too happy about this. They objected, saying, hey, this just isn't how things are supposed to work.
So it sounds like the clerk magistrate kind of went off script, and now the Supreme Judicial Court has to step in and decide if they were allowed to do that. It's like, can you actually do that?
Exactly. And that leads to the central legal question that the SJC had to wrestle with in this case. Did the clerk magistrate actually have the legal power, the statutory authority, to just hit the pause button on this application like that? Was that a legitimate move, or did it fall outside the bounds of the established rules? And beyond that, there was also the question of whether the Commonwealth even had the standing, the legal right to go to the SJC in the first place and ask them to review this kind of decision made by a clerk magistrate.
So it was about the power of the clerk magistrate and then about the Commonwealth's power to challenge that, right? Two sides of the same coin, in a way.
Yeah, I like that. Two sides of the same coin. And in the end, the SJC, they gave pretty clear answers to both questions. To that first question about whether the clerk magistrate had the authority to hold the application open like they did, their answer was a resounding no. They determined that the clerk magistrate stepped outside the boundaries of their legal power. And on that second question, they said, yes, absolutely, the Commonwealth did have the right to seek relief from the SJC. And the reason for that was precisely because there wasn't a normal appeals process in place for this kind of unusual action. It highlights a really important aspect of legal procedure. When something goes off the rails, deviates from the norm, the system needs a safety valve, a way to course correct.
It's like a check and balance on the system itself,
right?
To make sure it's functioning as intended.
Exactly. So now let's dive into the why. Why did the SJC reach that conclusion? What were the legal principles and statutes that guided their decision?
Yeah, let's break it down. What were the key points?
All right. So a big piece of their reasoning goes back to a specific statute, General Laws, Chapter 218, Section 35A. You know, this law lays out the duties of clerk magistrates when they receive an application for a criminal complaint. And the language used is really important. It says the clerk magistrate shall determine whether probable cause exists. And then based on that determination, they either grant the process, meaning allow it to move forward, or deny it. That word shall. It's not a suggestion. It's a directive.
So if I'm understanding correctly, what the SJC is essentially saying is that the law gives a very clear set of options, a fork in the road. Probable cause, you go this way. No probable cause, you go that way. There's no option to just hang out in the middle of the road.
Exactly. It's a binary. The statute sets up this binary choice. And holding the application open indefinitely just doesn't fit within that structure. And I think it's fascinating to consider how strictly the court interpreted that specific language in the statute. It really underscores the weight that legal drafting and interpretation carry. Precision matters.
Yeah, it's like trying to jam a square peg into a round hole. The existing law simply doesn't accommodate this holding open approach. But there's more to the SJC's decision than just this one statute, right? It goes deeper than that. We're also talking about a fundamental principle of our system of government, the separation of powers.
Oh, absolutely. This seemingly specific procedural question, it actually touches upon a much broader principle that underpins our whole system of governance. The SJC made it very clear that judicial officers, including clerk magistrates at this early stage of the process, can't overstep their bounds and interfere with the responsibilities of the executive branch. And when it comes to criminal law, that decision of whether or not to bring charges, that core prosecutorial function, that rests solely with the prosecutor.
Right. So by essentially hitting pause on that complaint and even imposing conditions on the juvenile, the clerk magistrate was essentially stepping into the prosecutor's shoes, right? They were influencing, or at least potentially influencing, the ultimate decision about whether to prosecute down the line.
Exactly. The SJC was very pointed about this in their decision. They wrote, and this is a quote worth remembering, "Judges and magistrates may not silence the voice of the people's elected prosecutors by delaying action." That's powerful stuff. It really gets at the core idea that the authority to decide whether to pursue a criminal case, it belongs to the Commonwealth's attorneys who are accountable to the public through the electoral process.
It's a stark reminder that everyone has their lane, so to speak, in the legal system. And there are good reasons for those boundaries. Now, we talked earlier about the Commonwealth facing a bit of a hurdle when it came to even appealing the clerk magistrate's decision to hold that complaint open. Why was that? And how did they finally get the SJC involved?
So this actually raises a really important point about legal remedies and how they work. Typically, if one party disagrees with a decision made in a lower court, there's a well-defined process for appeal. But in this situation, because the clerk magistrate hadn't actually issued a final decision, they hadn't formally granted or denied the complaint, there wasn't a final appealable order. So the Commonwealth found themselves in a bind. They believed the law wasn't being followed, but the normal routes for appeal, they weren't available.
It's like they hit a dead end, procedurally speaking. They needed a way to get the issue in front of a higher court.
Right. They needed a different tool. And that's where General Laws, Chapter 211, Section 3 comes into play. This statute gives the SJC a special power, often referred to as its superintendent's power. Think of it like this. It's the SJC's ultimate authority to ensure the lower courts are functioning properly, that they're operating within the bounds of the law. It allows them to step in, correct errors, and address big problems when there isn't another legal remedy available. The SJC saw this case as presenting just such a situation, a procedural impasse that needed their intervention. And for all you aspiring lawyers out there, understanding the scope and limitations of these kinds of extraordinary remedies, that's crucial.
So it was a unique situation that called for a unique solution. The SJC had to step in and untangle this procedural knot.
Exactly. So let's recap the key legal points for our listeners. The SJC ultimately ruled that the clerk magistrate didn't have the authority to hold that complaint open because, first, it went against the clear instructions of the statute that outlines their duties, and second, it stepped on the toes of the prosecutor, infringing on their fundamental discretion to decide whether to bring charges. And because there wasn't a normal appeals process that applied in this situation, the SJC exercised its supervisory power to address this procedural irregularity.
So it was a win for the Commonwealth on both counts. They were right about the clerk magistrate exceeding their authority, and they were justified in going to the SJC to get it resolved. Now, thinking about the bigger picture, what are the significant takeaways from this case? What are the lessons, especially for those of you who are on the path to becoming lawyers yourselves?
Well, I think this case offers several really important lessons. First and foremost, it demonstrates really vividly just how critical it is to understand the specific powers, and just as importantly, the limitations of each role within the legal system. You've got the judiciary, including clerk magistrates at this preliminary stage, and their job is to assess probable cause. Then you've got the executive branch, represented by the prosecutors, and they hold the discretion to decide whether to initiate a prosecution. These are distinct functions, and respecting those boundaries is crucial to upholding the rule of law.
Yeah, it's not just about knowing what you can do, but also knowing what you can't do. Those limits are just as important.
Absolutely. And this case drives home the point that even if you come up with a clever procedural workaround, a solution that seems practical or maybe even well-intentioned, if it doesn't square with the explicit requirements of the law, specifically the statutes, and with fundamental principles like the separation of powers, it can be ruled unlawful. For all of you future legal professionals out there, remember, you always need to ground your actions and your arguments in established legal authority.
You can't just make it up as you go along, right?
Exactly. And the SJC, they made that crystal clear. They said, and this is another quote worth noting, a magistrate does not have unbridled discretion to hold complaints open over the Commonwealth's objection. This really underlines the fact that even deviations from established procedures that are made with the best of intentions, they can still have big legal consequences.
So even if you think you're doing the right thing, if it's not procedurally sound, it can backfire.
Right. And this case also highlights the concept of prosecutorial discretion, the understanding that the decision of whether or not to bring charges and what charges to bring, that ultimately rests with the Commonwealth's attorneys. They're the ones who weigh the evidence, consider the public interest, and decide how to allocate resources when making those crucial decisions. The judicial role at this early stage is primarily focused on determining if there's enough evidence to even get the ball rolling to start the formal legal process.
So it's about keeping those roles distinct and recognizing the expertise and responsibility that each role carries. Now, I found it interesting that the court even addressed the idea of informal resolutions, which are pretty common, especially in less serious cases, you know, trying to find solutions outside of a formal prosecution when it makes sense.
Oh, for sure. And the court acknowledged the potential value of that approach, the benefits of informal resolutions in certain less serious situations. But they were also firm in saying that those informal approaches can't override established legal procedures. You can't just create shortcuts that bypass what the law explicitly requires.
So informal resolutions have their place, but they can't be used to circumvent the formal legal process.
Right. And Justice Abrams, in the court's opinion, made a very clear statement about this. The district attorney is the people's elected advocate. That really reinforces the idea of the responsibility for bringing criminal charges ultimately lies with those who are directly accountable to the public.
It's a reminder that the legal system is meant to be transparent and accountable to the people it serves.
Exactly. So if we're going to distill the core principle we've been talking about, I'd say it's this. In Massachusetts, clerk magistrates have a very specific legally defined role. When a criminal complaint is presented to them, they evaluate the evidence, they determine if there's probable cause. If there is, they grant the complaint, and if there isn't, they deny it. There's no middle ground, no legally recognized option to just put things on hold indefinitely. And this case really hammers home two key things. The importance of sticking to the rules, the statutory framework that governs legal procedures, and the fundamental principle of the separation of powers within our government.
Yeah, it's a great example of how a seemingly small procedural issue can actually connect to some really big legal concepts. It's not just about what happened in this one case, it's about how our system of justice operates as a whole.
Exactly. And for all our listeners out there who are future legal minds, this case is a valuable lesson in the importance of careful statutory analysis, really understanding the nuts and bolts of the law, and having a deep understanding of the different roles and responsibilities within the legal system. These are fundamental things that will shape your practice no matter what area of law you end up in.
This is the kind of stuff you'll carry with you throughout your entire legal career.
Absolutely.
So as you continue to think about this case and its implications, here's a thought-provoking question to consider. What if the legislature had created a specific mechanism in the law, a specific provision that allowed for this holding open procedure under certain defined circumstances? What kind of policy arguments could be made both for and against such a mechanism? It's a really interesting exercise in thinking about how legal procedures are designed and the potential consequences, intended or unintended, of different approaches.
That is a great question. You know, it really gets you thinking about the balance between flexibility and structure within the legal system. And if you're interested in exploring these concepts further, I'd encourage you to look into other cases that deal with the separation of powers, especially in the context of the criminal justice system. And of course, a deeper dive into the finer points of Massachusetts criminal procedure is never a bad idea for those of you studying law in this state.
It's all about connecting the dots, seeing how these principles play out in different contexts.
Exactly.
Well, thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Commonwealth v. Clerk of the Boston Juvenile Court. It's been a fascinating discussion.
I agree. It's a case that really gets you thinking.
Absolutely. And for all of you listening, keep those legal minds sharp, and we'll see you on our next deep dive.
See you then.